You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I'm Alicia Menendez of HuffPost Live, and today for Leonard Lopate, you're listening to WNYC and WNYC.org. As scientific mysteries go, one question is as big as the world itself. How are the astronomical events that created our solar system billions of years ago embedded inside humans? Neil Shubin, Associate Dean of Biological Studies at the University of Chicago and author of the best-selling book, Your Inner Fish, finds the answer to these questions in the ground and sky. His new book, The Universe Within, Discovering the Common History of Rocks, Planets, and People, shows how the entirety of the universe's 14-billion-year history can be seen in our bodies, and how the evolution of the cosmos has had profound effects on the development of human life on Earth. It's published by Pantheon, and I'm very pleased it brings Neil Shubin to the Leonard Lopate Show. Welcome.
Well, great to be here. Thank you.
You have worked as a paleontologist and traveled all over. How do you know where to look for fossils?
Yeah, it's definitely an acquired skill. I mean, we look over the globe for the likely places to find fossils because we look for rocks that have the right age to answer whatever question we're interested in, the right type of rock to hold fossils, and then we look for the places in the world that have those rocks exposed to the surface. So that search has taken me from Africa to the Arctic, to Greenland, to Ellesmere Island, and so forth.
Do you find similarities in fossils you find in locations that are far apart?
Ah, you bet. I mean, there are profound similarities among the fossils we find in Nova Scotia, in Connecticut, in Greenland, and in Morocco, which is amazing when you think about it. But the reality is those places were connected a long time ago, 200 million years ago. But there was no Atlantic Ocean. So geology helps you make sense of that and tell you where to look.
What types of soil conditions or environments are ideal for finding fossils?
Well, it depends what kind of fossil you're looking for. I mean, if you're looking for fossil fish, you want fossil lakes. You want things that are deposited as shales and so forth. If you're looking for land-living creatures, you're looking for sandstones and siltstones that were formed in streams and environments like that. Sometimes dunes are very good places to find fossils. So you gain a repertoire as a paleontologist of likely and unlikely rock environments that would preserve fossils. And it all depends on what you're looking for, because it's not dumb luck. We actually try to, you know, work for our luck.
My younger brother used to always dig big holes in our backyard in New Jersey. I suppose he's not going to be finding anything there.
It depends on where in Jersey he looks. Actually, there are dinosaur fossils from New Jersey, so, you know, who knows?
he's 27, but he will keep on looking.
Keep on digging.
What signs do you look for to know that fossils may be buried in the dirt or rock below?
Yeah, here's the trick. Okay, you're looking for bones that are weathering out on the surface. So we don't automatically dig just blindly. We walk. We spend lots of time walking. So when I was, you know, started our expeditions in the Arctic, we would spend about 10 hours a day walking 20 miles just looking at rock until we see little fragments of bone weathering on the surface. And it's those fragments that tell us where to dig. So we don't dig blindly. You know, we're looking for stuff that's actually weathering out by the natural erosion of rocks and so forth.
You're looking with your blind eye?
You bet I am. And you train your eye. You know, you go as a group and we each help each other. When one person sees bones, then the other people start to see it. You start to train your eye because we're, as human beings, really wonderful pattern recognition devices. You know, we can see patterns very easily. And it happens when you take a crew out in the field. In the first week, nobody finds anything. In the second week, everybody starts to find things.
How are fossils made? Where do they come from?
Well, fossils are actually, for a creature to become fossilized, really involves a very delicate balance of conditions. You know, obviously, the creature has to die. And then once it dies, it has to be buried very quickly and cannot be decomposed by bacteria. And so what that means is there are certain kinds of conditions which tend to preserve fossils beautifully. Places where there are anoxic, where there's not a lot of oxygen, tend to preserve the fossils very well. So fossilization is a pretty rare event.
Where are those places?
Well, for me, the places have been in the Arctic and Argentina and Africa and so forth. And those places tend to be the best environments for us to look at have been on streams. We've looked in the margins of streams. In the channels themselves, in ancient channels, you tend to find bits and pieces. But if you look in ancient margins of streams, you might even find whole skeletons like we have.
Are there certain types of organisms or bones that are more likely to be fossilized than others?
Yeah, you bet. So, I mean, anything that has hard parts like teeth and skeletons, that stuff tends to preserve much easier, than the soft parts like the skin and the flesh and the organs and brains. You know, unfortunately, those things don't fossilize easily and we don't have a great window on those. Or as good a window as we do, say, on teeth, which are really hard. You know, they're like rocks themselves. Or skeletons, yeah.
What do fossils tell us about our planet's past?
They tell us so much. I mean, fossils link the living to the past. I mean, when you compare fossils to living creatures, what you see is great connections among species alive today, among us and our closest relatives, living relatives, other primates. And it goes deeper still. I mean, you can follow that chain of relationship, that network of relationships, you know, from mammals to reptiles to fish to worms and on and on and on and on.
I'm Alicia Menendez. My guest is Neil Shubin, author of The Universe Within. Now, Neil, in 2004, you were part of the team that made paleontological history with the discovery of the fossil remains of the Tetalik. What is the Tetalik, and why was its discovery so significant?
Well, what happened was we actually went to Ellesmere Island in Canada, which is about 600 miles from the North Pole, to find a link between life in water and life on land, say, a fish with fins that had something approaching limbs. It took us 6 years, but after a bit, we found it. And this creature is about, 4 to 8 feet long. They vary in size. And they have a flat head, almost like a crocodile if you saw it. They have a neck that's not like a fish. But like a fish, they have scales on their back and fins with fin webbing. But when we opened up the fins, what you find is they have bones that compare to our own arms. They have an upper arm bone, a forearm, even parts of a wrist embedded in a fin with fin webbing. So it's a real mix of features of creatures that, lived in water and live on land.
So what does that tell us about our own evolution?
It really provides an important important data point, really, to see, our past when our common ancestor was fish. It's showing the origin of a neck. It's showing the origin of a wrist, which happened in creatures that we would recognize mostly as fish. But good parts of our own bodies arose in these fishy animals, and that's what fossils like this tell us. And it's along with other ones as well.
And do we have a sense of the geological and astronomical conditions that led to that evolution?
Yeah, you bet. We have an emerging picture of what the Earth looked like back then. We have some of the first land plants in these rocks. That I should say this creature is from rocks about 375 million years old. So this is when life is just beginning to emerge on land, and oxygen in the atmosphere is beginning to take off in a big way. It was very humid at that time period. And what we call the Arctic today was actually very humid and subtropical in its environment.
It was Miami.
Yeah, exactly.
Your book takes us through the history of our planet and the universe, starting with the Big Bang. What caused this event?
Oh, good question. So I don't know what caused the Big Bang, but I know what the consequences of the Big Bang were. Essentially, if you look at our bodies, we have over 3 billion years of the history of life, 4 billion years of the history of the planet, and links to over 13 billion years of the history of the universe. And the consequences of the Big Bang are really in the nuclei of the atoms which populate our bodies, which form our bodies, which form rocks, which form stars. That's the great link we have among ourselves and the rest of the universe.
So was all matter created by the Big Bang?
All the basic building blocks of matter, as well as the basic forces that we take for granted, like gravity and electromagnetism and so forth. So the consequences of the Big Bang that are with us today in terms of the matter that's in our bodies are the lightest elements, the nuclei of the lightest elements, namely hydrogen. And the heavier elements, like the carbon and the oxygen and the other things which make life possible, were actually born in the fusion reaction of stars. And even heavier elements came about in the explosion of stars, the supernovae that were spread about.
See, that would be a great book. Not that I come from fish, but that I come from stars.
Well, that's your independence, the universe within.
We can repurpose. Which elements were created first? Do we know that?
You bet. So the first one to come about were the nuclei of hydrogen, the lightest things, and hydrogen is lightest cousins. As you work your way up the periodic table, that thing we all studied in school, what you find is heavier and heavier elements emerging, with heavier and heavier nuclei. Because in the life of a star, in the evolution of a star, it consumes ever, ever heavier and heavier fuel, making ever and heavier byproducts.
I will be honest with you that I am not a math science person, though I once promised my math teacher in high school that if I had daughters, I would not tell them that I was not a math science person in order to make sure that they themselves were. So you'll have to forgive me for asking this, but how do these elements interact to create life as we know it?
Well, life itself is really a combination of elements and molecules, which has special properties. And those properties are it can replicate, it can make copies of itself. But very important for understanding the evolution of the world, it replicates with mistakes, with errors. Because if you have a situation where an entity, whether it's a molecule or anything else, can make copies of itself and do so with errors, then you have the setting for evolution by natural selection. So really, those are the preconditions for life taking off. And really, it's an open question whether, you know, life can arise on, and it just arose once on our planet or elsewhere, obviously.
How did physical forces like gravity come into play?
Well, gravity came about soon after the Big Bang, and that's through the interaction of the energy and the matter and the that occurred soon after the Big Bang. We're talking hundreds of thousands of years.
So I want to know how I came from the stars. What evidence is there of the Big Bang in our own bodies and the world around us?
Well, obviously, it's the links we have with the stars and the planets and so forth. That is, the signature of the nuclei of the atoms lies within us, and it's the same as within the stars itself. The deep, evidence that we have with the solar system, which is the molecules that make our body, they rain to the planet every day as in the form of meteorites and cosmic particles that contain the geological signature of the events that actually are responsible for the formation of the solar system over 4.6 billion years ago. So when you're looking at our history, really, it's important to think about like peeling an onion. You know, the first layers of history you see are the planetary aspects of our history. The ever deeper elements of our history are the ones associated with the solar system, and deeper still are with the origin of the universe itself. So peeling these layers apart, what you see is our atomic connections to the universe lie in those pieces that arose in the Big Bang and in the stars. The molecular portions, those combinations of atoms, are those that are shared with the processes that led to the solar system and planet. And our biological processes are due to really the interactions with the planet itself.
And how is it that Earth, out of all the other planets, was able to develop life?
Well, it's in the right place in the, you know, relative to the sun.
So we got lucky.
Yeah, you know, there's something to be said for luck. it's in the right place, in the right position to have the right balance of heat to maintain liquid water, to preserve the stability of conditions that allow life to happen. It also is in the right position in the solar system for it to have what's called plate tectonics, that is the internal forces of the Earth which lead to the movement of the continents.
Do you mean rotation?
Well, the rotation and the orbits of the Earth are also very important because mm-hmm. those two are connected to us as well. When you think of the orbit of the Earth and you think of the spinning of the Earth and you think of the rotation of the moon around us, those are the rotations that define our clocks and calendars. Well, now here's the cool bit. Those rotations are embedded in our own bodies.
How?
Well, every cell of our bodies, that is over 2 trillion of them, have a form of a clock inside them. And that clock is in the workings of DNA and proteins, that they rise and fall during the day. And they don't do so just on any sort of random cycle. They do so on a virtual, it's not exact, but a virtual 24-hour cycle. And so much of our health depends on the workings of those clocks. And that piece shows how deeply the rotations of the solar system are embedded in every cell of our body. And indeed, it has consequences for our lives today. Our moods, our eating disorders, our susceptibility to different diseases, including even cancer, can be related to, you know, disorders of some of these clocks.
And how do the sun and other planets and stars affect Earth?
Well, that's a really good question. So, sun certainly affects Earth because that's where all our energy comes from. But let's just take one example. Let's take Jupiter, which is the largest planet of the solar system. Right? Jupiter is the big one, and it affects so much of our planet. Indeed, it affects the orbit of our planet in very regular ways. So if you think of the orbit of our planet and the spinning of our planet and its relationship to the sun, those properties are defined by the gravitational pull of the other planets in our solar system, the biggest player of which is Jupiter. Well, it turns out the interaction of those forces leads to regular variations in the Earth's orbit, which themselves are responsible in part for the changes in the glaciers that extend from the poles, as they wax and wane in the past. And so much of our past is dependent on those glaciers, human history as well as human evolution, that it's not far-fetched to say that much of human evolution has been related to glaciers, which are related to our connection to the planet Jupiter.
Does the Earth have a tilt in its axis? Does that explain why I'm a little off-center?
Yeah, it has a tilt in the axis. And it most definitely, that's what's responsible for the seasons. And many of us suffer seasonal affective disorder because of that tilt.
So how does that come about?
Well, the tilt, that's a good question. The tilt is, you know, there's a couple of theories for that. One of the cool ones is that, you know, perhaps in the early days of the Earth, you know, about 4.4 billion years ago, as the planet was beginning to form, a giant Mars-sized asteroid whapped into the forming Earth. And that Mars-sized asteroid spalled off matter, which it ultimately congealed as the moon, but also may have resulted in the tilt of the Earth. So this theory, which is actually pretty well supported by the chemistry of moon rocks, by the chemistry and its similarity, the chemistry of the rocks of our crust, and other things as well, really says that perhaps it was an asteroid impact way back when that led to the tilt of the Earth and the origin of the moon. So much of our calendar may be due to a giant cataclysm, if that hypothesis is true.
Is it frustrating and or exciting to work in a field where so much of your work is about theories and knowing that you may never know?
Well, one of the things that's really great about it is, yeah, we have theories, but then you get some data that allows us to discriminate between different theories. See, ultimately, it is about the evidence. That's what makes the science. And so that's why we go out and collect fossils, because that's the hard evidence. We have lots of theories. But only some theories are, you know, only fit with the data we have, which is the fossils. Likewise, there are theories about the origin of the moon, but not all of them account for the beautiful near identical chemical signature portions of moon rocks to portions of the rocks of the Earth's crust.
Which similarities do we share with other planets?
Well, certainly in the molecules that are part of our own planet. You know, you take the carbon-based molecules, if you take the nitrogen-based molecules, a lot of those things are actually in our own body and are constituents of our planet are deeply shared. But another deep similarity is water. You know, life is possible by water, but water exists elsewhere in the solar system. And the water of our planet probably came through a number of places. It was carried here by comets, which exist in the solar system, perhaps by asteroids, and maybe even squeezed out of the minerals as of the early Earth as it was forming.
Throughout the history of our planet, many species have gone extinct, as we all know very well from Jurassic Park. How does the fossil record show that?
Well, the fossil record is a pretty humbling thing to look at. And the reason I say that is, and here's the bad news, every species goes extinct. You know, it's like extinction.
No, I don't believe it.
Yes. Extinction is the sort of the one law of nature we see in the fossil record. You know, no species lasts forever. They all have their moment. And there are periods of time where many species disappear very abruptly. But, you know, extinction is sort of a part of it. So, you know, it's a useful question to ask is what's the lifespan of our own species? And if so, you know, what is the future of our own species?
I'm Alicia Menendez in today for Leonard Lopates, speaking with Neil Shubin, the author of The Universe Within. You're listening to WNYC and WNYC.org. What are some of the causes of extinction?
Yeah, so if you look at extinction, there's a couple different kinds, right? So there are the big massive extinctions, the ones where, you know, species from around the planet die out nearly simultaneously. And there are those that are sort of more background, that always sort of happen in the background. So when you think about the kinds of causes of the big ones, the big cataclysmic extinctions, the main hypothesis that explains at least one of the big extinctions, of which there are five in the fossil record, is the asteroid impact hypothesis. That, you know, at some point in the distant past, and, you know, over 60 million years ago, a giant asteroid hit the Earth, caused major climatic changes, which led to ecological and biological collapse, which itself led to the demise of numerous species. But there are other mechanisms as well. There are mechanisms that relate to volcanism, maybe widespread volcanism at different times, ejected material in the atmosphere, which caused a similar sort of ecological collapse. But then there are other mass extinctions that existed in the distant past, where we really don't have a compelling explanation yet. There doesn't seem to be an asteroid impact. There doesn't seem to be volcanism. So it's in some, we're still looking for the smoking gun.
Which do I need to be most worried about today?
Asteroid impacts, we kind of know when they're coming, right? The thing you should be most worried about is humans. You know, it's the sixth extinction, which is the big mass extinction mechanism, which is a human being and human impacts. I think that's the one I'm more worried about them than asteroids.
How does the extinction, though, of one species lead to opportunities for another?
You bet. So, you know, think of a game of King of the Hill, right? I mean, you might have the bully at the top of the hill and pushing you down as you try to get up. But if some random event removes the bully, you know, his mom calls him home, all of a sudden you have an opportunity created. So, you know, extinction by removal of competitors can make opportunities for species. And that's one of the theories behind the success of our own lineage, mammals. Perhaps by the extinction of dinosaurs, over 60 million years ago. That created opportunities for our distant ancestors, the mammals that were around at that time.
What makes one species more likely to survive a catastrophic event than another?
Well, there's lots of properties that may tell the tale. One of them is perhaps that species that live in a lot of different places on the globe that are very widespread may be buffered from extinctions. Maybe there'll be a local effects, but they'll be buffered because they're spread out and they can cover themselves in other ways. And so that seems to be the one property that explains much of the survivorship of mass extinctions we see in the fossil record.
In addition to the many extraterrestrial forces at work on Earth, there are terrestrial ones as well, such as plate tectonics and continental drift. Can you just explain how those work?
Yeah, continental drift and plate tectonics, that's one of the great stories of science. That's one of the huge revolutions in thinking that happened in the last 40, 50 years. And, it's kind of an outgrowth of the Cold War, and people discovered what was going on in the ocean floor. And as they discovered what was going on in the ocean floor, they discovered that our world was way more dynamic and changeable than anyone could really imagine. That new seafloor is being created at the center of oceans, at these big rifts, and seafloor is being destroyed elsewhere on the planet. What that is, it's an engine. It's an engine for moving the continents about. But importantly, it's not just an engine for changing the face of the Earth. It's an engine, perhaps, for also changing the atmosphere and the climate of the Earth. Because the more we look, the more we find that rock, water, air, and life are linked. And they're linked in the ways that atoms like carbon and oxygen and so forth cycle through the system.
What does the fossil record tell us about the separation of the continents?
Yeah, it's pretty cool. So if you were to look at the fossils of rocks about 200 million years ago, what you'd find is the fossils of Connecticut and New Jersey and Pennsylvania look more or less similar to those of Greenland and look more or less similar to those that are discovered in Morocco. Right, and the reason for those similarities is not because those creatures swam across the ocean. I mean, it's because, like a jigsaw puzzle, Morocco, North Africa.
That's where we fit.
Yeah, it's where we fit. There's all one giant rift valley where we're sitting right now.
What happened to oxygen levels in the atmosphere as the continents separated?
Yeah, so they did go up, and they went up pretty dramatically from the pre-split. And one theory is that perhaps in the moving of the continents, you've created a lot of coastline. And as you create a lot of coastline, you create a lot of area for erosion. And that was led to the burial of muds that would actually serve to consume oxygen. There's these muds at the bottom of the sea that do that. And so that removal of the sink for oxygen led to the rise in oxygen levels.
So what effect did that have on developing life?
Well, when you think about oxygen, oxygen's the fuel for so much of what life does on the planet. It really provides the mechanism for exchange of electrons, which is very important for having a high-energy lifestyle. So perhaps it's no accident that the origin of mammals with a placenta for gas exchange, the origin of warm-blooded mammals that have that kind of apparatus, may have come about when there was such a rise in oxygen.
You write that the subcontinent of India slamming into Asia gave rise to color vision.
Well, wow. Yeah. Clearly, the one of the neat theories, and it's a controversial theory, and is one proposed by a geologist by the name of Maureen Ramo, who's at Columbia University at Lamont Doherty Geological Observatory. And she proposed with colleagues about two decades ago a bold hypothesis, which was controversial, is that perhaps rock weathering, which we knew about, is related to the cycle of carbon through the biosphere. She proposed a hypothesis with her colleagues that the rise of the Tibetan Plateau is associated with a drop in global temperatures because the rise of the plateau led to an increase in weathering, which led to a drop in atmospheric carbon dioxide. It's a long way of saying you have the chain reaction of events where things got colder around the globe as the result of the rise of the Tibetan Plateau. Whatever the reason for this, it's very clear that color vision arose about that time when the Earth got colder, and that was due to a change in vegetation. More leafy.
So before this, people are seeing in black and white?
No, not people. Distant ancestors, mammals. They were seeing. They had two options, and they were seeing in a version of color, but it was much more like black and white than it is what we see. They weren't being able to perceive much in the red-green color scale. So that came about through a duplication of one of these genes of opsins over about 40 million years ago, and that enabled the primates that lived at that time, presumably, to discriminate among different kinds of leafy leaves that vary in their red-green color scale. So clearly, climate change is related to the origin and proliferation of color vision, and that climate change may be linked to large geological changes, namely one of the biggies may be the uplift of the Tibetan Plateau.
Are there other global events like that that have had a direct impact on human evolution?
Oh, yeah, glaciers. Oh, my gosh, yeah. The glaciers have come and gone. And as glaciers come and go, they change global environments. And they've affected human history, but they've also perhaps affected human evolution as well, creating open landscapes, for instance, for our distant ancestors to walk.
You discussed the importance of the element carbon to life on Earth, which is described as being carbon-based. What does that mean?
Well, carbon-based life is what we are. It's organic life. And carbon's a wonderful molecule because many different compounds can be made of it. And we trace, that's the one thing that all life on Earth shares, indeed. But it's also shared chemically with other cousins, molecular cousins, within the solar system.
All right. Well, it has been so wonderful. I've been speaking with Neil Shubin about how evidence of the history of the universe can be found in every human body. His book, The Universe Within, Discovering the Common History of Rocks, Planets, and People, is published by Pantheon. Neil, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.